My name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. Anybody got any more jokes they want to tell? You know, I was starting to wonder about Harry, how smart he was, but when he asked his wife to be on the program, I thought that was brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Good luck tonight on that. I know that's going to work out all right for you. I know how it would have been if I had not asked my wife to have got up and been on the program. But anyway, I want to thank the committee for inviting me to be here tonight. It's really an honor to be asked to go to anywhere to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an honor to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because there was for a long time in my life that nobody wanted me to go anywhere. And so when I'm asked to go, I go, no matter what it is. When I'm asked to serve, I try to serve. I want to take a minute, and I want to follow Bo's lead. I want to thank Jerry and Jill so I don't get that hum in the middle of this talk. I want to thank them for taping this thing. I love that, Jerry. That was great. But we've had some great speakers this weekend, and I have thoroughly enjoyed myself. I really have. And it's been good. It's been good for me. And I really identified with Tim talking about his mother, because I lost my father in May. And I retired 2 years early to help take care of him. And I'm grateful every day that I did that. Absolutely grateful every day that I did that. My parents didn't raise me to be an alcoholic. My parents raised me to be a Catholic priest. And they almost got their wish. Absolutely almost got their wish. I was raised in Decatur, Georgia, which was a small town at that time, right outside Atlanta. And my family had lived in the Decatur, Shamley, Dunwoody area for years. My great-grandfather owned all the property where Peachtree DeKalb Airport is now. And they were sawmillers, and they'd cut the lumber during the week, and on the weekends they'd load it up on the wagons with the mules, and they'd haul it into Atlanta and sell it at the merchandise mart. And so I had a long history, a family history in the area there. And my family was very well respected, not because they were wealthy, but because they were good people. My parents weren't wealthy. We weren't poor, but we weren't wealthy. We had everything that we needed. But like I said, I was raised in the church, and every time that door opened, boy, we were there. We were absolutely there. And I've always been one that would pick out people to be heroes for me. And many of those priests that I became involved with over the years in school became my heroes. And so after my education, after my 12 years, I figured it was time for me to fulfill my obligation, and that was exactly what my mother and my little Irish grandmother wanted me to do, and I went to the seminary. My first year in college was in Coleman, Alabama, at St. Bernard Seminary. The abbot there was a drunk, and he's now a member of this fellowship. You know, he's a member of this fellowship. But I wasn't there long, and I realized that that those guys had something that I didn't have. And I had absolutely no idea what it was. But I knew that I didn't fit. I just didn't fit. And these were some good men. These were good men. And they had their sense of direction. They knew where they were going. And I did not. And as it turned out, I was miserable being there. So after the first year, I decided I wasn't going back. I was going to come home and go to college. I had turned down an offer to go to the Naval Academy to go in the seminary. And of course, by the time I came out, of the seminary, the academy appointment was gone. And so I figured, well, I'll go home and I'll go to Georgia Tech just like my grandfather and my father did. And I felt very uncomfortable when I came home. Now, nothing was said to me by my parents. Nothing was said to me by my mother or my little Irish grandmother. But I felt uncomfortable. I thought I had failed them. I found out years later, I did not fail them. They didn't want me to stay, if that's not where I wanted to be. But in my mind, I thought I'd failed. So I immediately went down and enlisted in the United States Air Force. I took the test to go to flight school, and flight school was full. And they said, why don't you go ahead and enlist, and we'll send you to a technical school, and if a flight school opens up, we'll put you in it. And so I went down there on Ponce de Leon Avenue in Atlanta, and I stood out there and waited on a bus after they swore me in, and I went to Lackland Air Force Base to go to basic training. And I met two of my sponsors there. Man, let me tell you, these guys didn't have any sense of humor at all. We're talking about sense of humor this weekend, but those drill instructors have no sense of humor at all. I had been not pampered, but my parents wouldn't make me eat anything I didn't really want. And, well, when I got there, I'm telling you, that changed, you know. You had to eat what was on your tray, and you better eat all of it. And anyway, I finished basic training, and I went to a technical school in Amarillo, Texas. Now, I had... In high school, guys would open a beer and I'd take a sip of it. And I thought, golly, Moses, how do they drink that stuff? You know. Well, Shepherd Air Force Base, where I was going to technical school, the guys got me and said, "You want to go to the club? Let's go to the club." I said, "Okay." So I went to the club with them, and I started telling them stories about things that happened in my childhood, and they were all laughing, and they were pouring me beer, and I was drinking it, and all of a sudden, something happened. I was okay. The world was okay. You know, you were okay. That little space and time was right there when I thought, this is wonderful. And they liked me, you know, but I went overboard. As we know how we do that, we go overboard. And, of course, I drank way too much. We were walking back to the barracks, and I was walking down the road, and I flipped a cigarette out in the street, and I heard these brakes. And I turned around, and it was the air police. And the guy walks up and says, "I want you to field strip that cigarette." And field stripping is where you tear the cigarette open, you take the tobacco out, and you put the paper in your pocket. Well, I told him what he could do with his cigarette, you know. And so they put me in the back, and they carried me down to the brig. So here I am. I'm on my first outing with alcohol, and I'm already locked up. Well, most people would say, you know, hey, that's not a good thing. When they got me out the next morning, and I went back to school, the only thing I could think about was how much fun I had last night and how that alcohol did that for me. You know, it really did. And that's all I could think about. I didn't think about being locked up or any of the trouble or anything. And that was a pattern through my whole life. It was like that. I got through with technical school, and I went to McClellan Air Force Base in California and was stationed there. And after I was there about 10 weeks, they had an opening in flight engineer school down in Orlando Air Force Base. And so I left and I went down to Orlando Air Force Base. And the whole time in California, man, I was drinking, having a good time. I mean, you know, it was wonderful. Here I am, a little guy from Georgia, and I'm in California, and whew, things are wonderful, you know. And so I went down to Orlando and got in the school down there, and I remember thinking, when I went in that school, I was thinking, you know, I can't drink while I'm here. I've got to pass this course. because the washout rate was tremendous. And if you washed out, that was it. And I was afraid I'd wash out. But and I don't know why at that early stage I would think, I can't drink. But I guess something inside of me knew that when I drank, I wasn't completely in control. And so I didn't drink. But I roomed with a guy that did. And he'd come in the middle of the night, you know, just ranting and raving and raising Cain. And I was trying to get all my studies done, but I wanted to pass that class. I wanted to fly. And I graduated third in my class. And the guy that was in my room, they rifted him out. And I don't know where he went. I've never seen him since then. But he rifted out because he didn't quit drinking to go to that school. I left there and I went to the Azores, flying C-54s in air sea rescue, and it was a good job. But we flew standby and alert, and then we'd fly missions, and then when we were off, we were at the clubs. We were at the clubs. I mean, it was just a big old rock sitting out in the middle of the ocean, and there's nothing to do there. So we spent time at the club, and I had three or four run-ins, you know, but it wasn't my fault. It was my roommate's fault, you know, because he'd want to fight, and, you know, I'd try to stop him, and they'd want to fight me, too. And I'm a small man. I'm not a fighter, you know, but I seem to be getting in more and more trouble. Anyway, I spent 18 months there, and I left there and came home, and I wanted to go to California. I put in to go to Travis Air Force Base in California because I want to go back out there. Man, the girls out there, you're beautiful, you know. And so they sent me to Dobbins Air Force Base in Marietta, Georgia, 13 miles from where I was raised. Well, that wasn't where I wanted to be, you know, because there, 13 miles away, you not only have your home, you got your mother, your father, you know, and your friends. You know, you don't want to be around your friends when you're running around doing what I was doing. But anyway, I tried to get the assignment changed, and I couldn't get it changed. So I came home and didn't have a girlfriend, didn't know who to date. You know, everybody had gone to the Four Winds. A lot of the people had gone to colleges. A lot of them were out of college, and they were gone. And I ran into a friend of mine one day, and he says, are you dating anybody? And I said, no. I said, I'm not. And he said, I know a girl that you might call, and she might go out with you. And I said, a blind date? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, that might work okay. So I called this girl on a Saturday, and I introduced myself, and I said, I'm stationed at Dobbins Air Force Base, you know, airman, flying airplanes, you know, and thought, I'm really going to impress this girl. And I said, would you like to go out tonight? And she said, well, I don't know. She said, you know, I've got plans to go to the lake with a bunch of people, and she said, I think I'd just really rather go with them. I thought, well, how dare you? So I said, well, I don't need her. I'm not going to call her back, you know. So I called her the next day, and I said, would you like to go out and go to a movie? And she says the magic word, you got any beer? And I said, I don't have any, but my dad's got some in the refrigerator. I said, I can get it. She said, well, get some beer and come pick me up. And I said, okay. So I went in there and stole my dad's beer and put it in the car and went and picked her up. And we went to the Starlight Drive-In out on Piedmont Avenue. And we stayed there for maybe 2 hours. And then she said, I'd like to do something different. I said, you want to go climb Stone Mountain? She said, yes. Yeah. So we went out and climbed Stone Mountain. And at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, it was just a mountain then. It wasn't a park. And so we went out and climbed Stone Mountain. And I remember when she walked out of that house and was coming down those steps to meet me, I looked at her and I thought, my gosh, now she's got something I want. She really does. Because she was the cutest little thing you ever saw, a little pink halter and pink shorts. And so we started dating, and I never did know exactly how she felt about Mia, but I'd ask her if she wanted to go here, wanted to go there, and she said, yeah. And we started a pattern of going to the clubs, you know, at Dobbins, and then go to some of the places, the other clubs around Marietta. And she'd drive up, and then I'd end up driving her back home, you know. But we'd run, and we'd dance, and we'd drink, and we just, she loved to dance, and she loved to drink, and was just, everything was wonderful, you know. And we did that for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, she said, let me tell you something, Airman. She said, we're going to either get serious about this thing or we're going to get gone. And I realized that I was going to lose her. And I couldn't take that chance. And so I asked her to marry me. And so we got married. And we're still married today. Been married 44 years. But, thank you. By the grace of God, and Al-Anon, and AA, and everything else, you know. But anyway, we got married, and we moved into a little apartment in Decatur. And I was flying all over the country, and my life was just wonderful, wonderful, you know. Doing what I really wanted to do, and had this beautiful wife, and she came home one day and said we're going to have a baby, and so I thought, well, that's wonderful, and so I go to the base to tell everybody that I'm going to be a father, and this is going to be wonderful, and my squadron commander said I need to see you in my office, and so he took me in his office and he said you got orders to go to Vietnam. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, my wife is pregnant. Can you get me out of that? Oh, well, why didn't you tell me that? No problem. He said, I'll get you out of that. I said, you won't have to go. Well, what he did, he got it deferred for 9 months. And so my first daughter, Karen, who is now a black belt Al-Anon, was born. And right after she was born, I left. And I went down to Eglin Air Force Base, and I met the crew that I would be flying with. And the nine crews of us, we practiced and we trained and practiced short field landings and short field takeoffs and on the C-123, which is that's what the C-123 is a short field takeoff airplane. And I spent 3 months down there, and Carol came down and stayed with me the last week that I was down there, and then we came home, and in 2 days I left to go to South Vietnam. My life was fixing to change big time, big time. I had absolutely no idea what to expect, you know. I wasn't raised, I didn't have a sheltered life, but I had never been exposed to a lot of things in life that I was going to be exposed to when I went to Vietnam. The awesome amount of death, and flying in and out of fields that were under fire, and dragging soldiers up on the airplane, and wounded, and them dying on the way back, and there were a few things that happened to me I need to tell you about, because I need to tell you how I handled this. The first thing is we were coming back to Saigon with a bunch of wounded soldiers out of the Big Red One, and there was a kid right outside the cockpit there, and he was laying on another boy's leg, and he is muddy, and he's a little blonde-headed kid, and he reminded me of my brother. Looked just like my brother. And so I looked out of the cockpit at him, and he looked back at me, and he smiled. And when he did, I gave him a thumbs up, you know, and he kind of smiled at me. And so in a minute, I looked back at him again, and he had this blank look on his face. And this kid he was laying on was trying to cover his face with his T-shirt. First time I ever saw anybody die. I mean, just sat and watched them die, especially an 18-year-old boy. You know, what a waste. Anyway, I went on, and of course, you can't tell anybody this bothers you. You know, you can't tell. You know, you go fly, you go see all this, you do what you got to do. You go in the crew lounge at night, you drink four quick, fast beers, you know, and then you go to the barracks and you go in the shower, and that's, I'll tell you a little secret. That's where people do their crying, is in the shower. You go in the shower and you turn the shower on over your head, and you stand there and you cry. And nobody knows you're crying. Because the Air Force said you're a big boy, you're not supposed to cry. And you can do anything you want to do. You don't need anybody. You know, they taught me that. They drilled that into me. On August the 16th, 1966, I was on a low-level drop mission. And what we did, we dropped packages and pallets into special forces camps. And we had to fly about 25 or 30 feet off the ground and drop them, because if it got outside the camp, then Charlie got it. And if, you know, you had to make sure you got it in. On the first run, we didn't pick up any hits at all, because Charlie didn't know where we were coming from. But with the winds like they were, he knew that we'd have to come back the same way. And on the second run, we picked up all kind of hits. We must have picked up about 30 or 35 hits. And one of them came through the bottom of the airplane and got me in the leg and went up and took off a piece of my ear. And your cartilage in your ear is full of blood. Well, you know that or not, but you just bleed like crazy. And it felt like a bee sting, you know, and I kept slapping my head and I had blood all over me. And so we headed back to Benoit Air Base, and we landed, and I went immediately to the clinic. Well, after I got hit, I realized the navigator was hit also, who was sitting right outside the cockpit. And he took one through the leg, and they had put a tourniquet of a guy's belt on his leg. And it had severed the bone in his leg, and he was on his way home. Anyway, I was off for 24 hours, and then we were back to flying. We flew 16 days on and maybe a day or two off. And we flew flare missions. I sprayed defoliant. I sprayed Agent Orange. I flew drop missions. I flew paratroopers, all of that. And just before I was due to rotate, home in October. And one of the guys on my crew was a guy named Captain George Grady and Cooper, Captain George Grady Cooper. And he was my hero. You know, I told you I had heroes. Well, he was my hero. This guy could do anything, absolutely anything. Master skydiver, I mean, a master scuba diver, flew gliders, you name it, he could do it, you know. And he was my John Wayne. No doubt about that. He asked me, would I stay in Vietnam and extend and stay with them? And I was a basket case. I said, I don't think I can do it. I got to go home. He said, well, think about it and let me know. And I just about made the decision to do it. And we got diverted to a field one day in a place called Song Bay. And it's in South Vietnam, and you landed on the main street of town, and you had to land to the left, or you'd take down all the light poles on the right. And there was a big mountain at the end of the runway, so you had to come in over the mountain and swoop in and land. And they diverted us into there because the North Vietnamese were overrunning that field. And we turned around, and we never shut the engines down, and we got off the airplane, and we started dragging guys up on the airplane. And this major came by, and he said, pick up the wounded and leave the dead. And so we said, okay. And so we started dragging the ones up that looked like they were still alive, and we piled them up on the airplane just like you'd pile up cordwood. That's not pretty, but you got to get out of there. You got to get out of there. And so I remember the loadmaster hollering back at me, and he said, sir, you see any more? And I remember making kind of a little less turn through there, and I didn't see any. And I said, I don't think so. And he said, let's go. And so I went up the side of the airplane, and I had to step on some of those guys to get up to the cockpit. Got in the cockpit, and we took off. And when we took off, they nailed us to the wall. And we had to immediately bank to the left, or we'd have hit that mountain. And when we banked to the left, I looked back out the window, and I saw two guys sitting up on the end of that runway. And I remember thinking, that's my fault. I left those two guys there. You know, they're going to die, and it's because of me. And I remember the co-pilot said, "What are you looking at?" And I said, "Nothing." And he said, "Well, you keep looking back. You must see something." And I said, "Nothing." And I thought, this is something I'll have to take to my grave. I cannot, absolutely cannot let them know that I cost those two boys their lives. About a week later, I told Captain George Grady Cooper that there was no way I could stay in Vietnam, that I had to go home. And on October 15th, I got orders to go back to the States, to Houston. When I left Vietnam, they gave us orders and said, as soon as you hit the United States, the continental United States, you take your uniforms off and you put on civilian clothes. And I thought, well, that's strange. Why would they do that? Well, when I landed at Travis Air Force Base and took a bus over to San Francisco International, I found out why. They were demonstrating out there. They threw coffee on us. They called us baby killers. They just didn't show us any mercy at all. I couldn't change my clothes in San Francisco, but the minute I got to Dallas, I changed my clothes. And when I arrived home in Atlanta, a basket case, I was in civilian clothes. And they were demonstrating there, raising Cain, baby killers. I couldn't imagine what had happened because, see, I'd only been gone a year, and it wasn't that way when I left. So that's why whenever I meet anybody that has been to Vietnam, and if there's anybody in here that's been to Vietnam, welcome home. Welcome home. Because we never got it. I got my wife and my daughter, who didn't know me, and we went to Houston. And I went down there flying for a colonel who was the commander of the Civil Air Patrol for the United States. It was a good job, and it was a beautiful airplane, a Convair 440. And everything was clicking fine, except I still had me with me. And I'd go off flying somewhere, and I'd come back, and I wouldn't go home. And I'd go down to the Hollywood Bar on Old Galveston Road, right outside the base, and I'd sit there till they closed. And I'd try to get drunk enough to come home to where I could sleep, because I could not sleep. I dreamed about these boys' mothers, that they were condemning me for costing them their lives. I dreamed about all those other boys that I had seen die, and it was just eating my lunch. But you can't tell anybody, right? Because you're a man. God made you a man, and you're supposed to handle this stuff. Air Force told me that. Anyway, we were down there, and Carol was still drinking with me and when I would come home. And I remember sitting in that Hollywood bar one night, and this guy's sitting in the bar next to me, and he says, "My gosh, look over there." And I looked over at the door, and there stood my wife and my little daughter, who was in her pajamas and her robe, and she's motioning to me to come over to the door. And I walked over there, and she's crying, and she said, "Won't you please come home?" And I told her, I said, "How dare you embarrass me in front of my friends?" That's how sick I was. And she turned around and walked off. Things got worse and worse. I wrecked an automobile down there. We were going to divorce. I'm through with you. I'm leaving. You know, we got drunk one night, and I threw all my clothes in the car and drove two houses up, hit a parked truck, totaled a car. You know? Just the normal things that happen in family life, right? Anyway, I went to the base one morning, and they said, you need to go up to base operations. There's a major up there looking for you. So I went up there, and this major was there, and he said, you remember me? And I said, yes, sir, I remember you. And he said, I came to tell you that Grady Cooper is dead. And he said, they crashed, and they died. Everybody on the airplane died. And I immediately said, if I had been there, it would not have happened. If I had been with him, he would not have died. So I did what every good drunk would do. I went by and got me a fifth of scotch, and I went home, and I sat down in a recliner chair, and I proceeded to get drunk. And that's exactly what I did. I sat there, and I got drunk. And that bothered me for a long time. About 2 weeks later, they called me to the ordinary room and they said, we've got orders for you to go back to Vietnam. I said, not me. I just got back. And they said, well, you need to go see the squadron commander. So I went in to see the squadron commander and he said, we got orders for you to go to Vietnam. And I said, well, I'm not going back. I said, I just got back. And he said, you don't understand. You're in a critical career field. And I said, yeah, it's critical because they're shooting all of us down, Colonel. That's what's the matter. I said, they're killing all of us and I am not going back. I went home and told my wife, I said, start packing, we're going home. I had 8 years in the United States Air Force. I had 29 air medals. I had Purple Heart, Commendation Ribbon, which is the same as a Bronze Star. And my career was sailing, and I was dying inside. This colonel said, if I ever saw anybody who was Air Force 100%, that was you. I can't picture you getting out of the service. I said, well, Colonel, you just sit behind that desk and watch me. I'm gone. And I got it. 3 days later, I was discharged. I got out. We came home to Atlanta. No place to live. Carol was pregnant with our second child. Didn't know what we were going to do. Didn't have a job. So I proceeded to run around with some of the old buddies that I had, you know, and drink and I knew what to do, you know. But she kept telling me, you've got to get a job. We can't live with Mama forever, you know. And of course, I didn't have any insurance. And the Air Force said they would not cover it if I got out. So there we were. She's pregnant. So I had dinner with a friend of mine one night, and he said, why don't you go over to one of the airlines and put in an application to go to work? And I said, okay, I think I will. So I went over there and put in an application. And the guy said, the only thing we're hiring right now is in the maintenance and engineering department. And I said, I'll take it. And so I went to work. I went to work for that. I was out about 30 days, and I went to work for the airline in Atlanta. And we said, well, we'll move out. We'll get us a house. We'll rent it for a while, and then we'll buy us a house. Things are going to be better, I promise you, you know. Always going to be better. And so we moved out from our mother, and we rented a house, and then we were able to buy a house. And so we bought a house, and I was having real problems adjusting with not being in the Air Force, but yet couldn't sleep at night. I mean, you know, it's a catch-22 situation. I missed flying. I missed flying all over the place, but yet I couldn't sleep at night, you know. I ain't had any business flying. I was a basket case. So anyway, we said, I tell you what we need to do. We need to move out to Stone Mountain. A lot of nice families out there. Let's move out there. So we bought a house and we moved out to Stone Mountain. Things are going to be better. Things are going to be better. So in 1972, Carol, we're sitting at the table, 2 o'clock in the morning, drinking like most other couples in the neighborhood, of course. And we're sitting there drinking and cussing each other and carrying on, telling each other how bad we can't stand each other, but neither one of us would leave, you know. You know, as I look back today, we were so sickly dependent on each other. We couldn't live with each other and we couldn't live without each other. We really couldn't. God did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves. Anyway, 1972, she gets up and I get up and go to bed, and she picks up the phone and calls Alcoholics Anonymous. And she went to some meetings at the Tucker Group, and So one night she says to me, would you like to go to one of these meetings with me? Well, I didn't know anything about AA. I'll tell you what I knew about AA. I was sitting in Vietnam on Tudor Street on my day off one day with another pilot, and we're drunk, and I asked him, I said, Frank, you think we're alcoholics? He said, alcoholics don't fly airplanes. I said, by God, you're right. You know? So I ruled it out. I ruled that out. But she was going to AA, so she said, would you like to go to this meeting with me tonight? And I thought, well, I'll go over and see what's going on. Maybe I can help her. So I go over there. And sound familiar, Bo? So I go over there, and we sit in the meeting, and then they split up. And she says to me, you go in that room, and I'm going to stay in here. And I said, okay. So I get up with these people, and I walk into this room, and I sit down, and they're going around the room. You know, I'm an alcoholic. I'm Barbara, I'm an alcoholic. You know, just going on around. Well, they get to me, and I said, my name's Jim. My wife says I have a drinking problem. And this guy sitting next to me says, I doubt that very seriously. I like that guy. I really did like that guy immediately. And I said, why do you say that? And he said, well, he said, son, I probably spilt more liquor than you've ever drank. And I thought, we're going to get along here. He and I are going to get along. I said, would you do me a favor? Would you step out of the car and tell my wife that? He said, sure. So the meeting was over, and she's out in the car, and I walked out there, and I introduced this guy to her, and I said, he's got something he wants to tell you. And he said, looks as if he takes his head in the car and says, ma'am, I don't think he's alcoholic. He said, I've seen a lot of alcoholics, and I just don't think your husband's one of them. He said, I probably spilt more liquor than he ever drank. And she looked at me and said, get in the car. You know, she is mad. So I got in the car, and we went home, you know. And we may have stopped and got something to drink on the way home. I don't know. But anyway, she went to AA, and she was in and out for about 6 weeks. And then finally, she quit going. That was in 1972. We rocked along there just fighting and carrying on, and our whole house was just a disaster area. Our third child was born. Sheila, and so we had three children, three girls. I had three girls. I'm just overrun with girls. And so in 1980, we're sitting there at the kitchen table again, you know, like everybody else in the neighborhood. And 3 o'clock in the morning, and we're talking this whole thing over, you know. And she's telling me, she would tell me things like, if you would tell me what's going on with you, maybe we could get it straightened out. And I'd say, well, you know, it's absolutely no business of yours what's going on with me. You know, I really believe that. I really believe that. That's sad to be married to a partner and then tell her that it's none of her business what's going on with you. She knew I was having problems, but she didn't know what they all were. She knew I was drinking like crazy, but she was too. You know, but it was easier for me to blame it on her. We went to marriage counselors, we went to priests, we went to psychologists, we went everywhere. I'd get home in the afternoon some days, and she'd say, get in the car. I said, where are we going? Get in the car. And she'd take me up to see this. She took me to see a priest one time, and I convinced him that she was the problem. And then she's ready to go. She said, let's go. I said, no, I'm not through here. You know? Because I had him on my side. A couple of things happened in 1979. We had a mission in our church, and so I went to this mission, and I went and talked to this priest, and I thought, I'm going to tell him what's going on with her, and maybe he can give me some words of wisdom. And so I went and talked to him, and he said, have you ever tried AA? I said, me? He said, yeah, you. I said, no. I said, she has. I said, it's for her, not for me. And he said, no. He said, Jim, I think you're the one that needs AA. Well, I could see right then I had failed. I have not explained this thing to him properly, you know. And so I left. And then one night we're sitting at the table and we're drinking. and it was about 2 in the morning, and I got up and went to the bathroom, and I came back, and she says, the telephone's for you. And I thought, I didn't hear that phone ring. So I picked up the telephone, and I said, hello. And this guy said, Jim. I said, oh, yeah, hi. He said, my name's Jim, too, and I'm an alcoholic. I said, I'm sorry. He said, your wife says you have got a drinking problem. I said, why did you call me? He said, I didn't. Your wife called me. I said, she needs to talk to you. I gave her the phone. I said, don't you ever do that to me again. So she took the phone. A few weeks later, things kept getting worse and worse, and she called Alcoholics Anonymous seriously. And she started going to AA meetings at Clarkston in Decatur. I'd come home in the evening and she'd say, the kids have been bathed, the food's in the oven, and I'm going to a meeting. And she'd get in the car and leave. I thought, well, doggone, I've been to one of those things, but I don't know what the attraction is over there, you know. But she had quit drinking. And then she'd come home and she'd say crazy things like, well, Gay says I don't have to accept that. And I thought, well, who is Gay? You know, well, Sarah says so-and-so, so-and-so, you know, and she's getting all this information that's bad information. So I'm getting a little bit concerned about her. And anyway, she rocked on along there. And so I came home one day, and on the way home from work, I stopped and looked at this boat this guy had right around the corner there, a bass boat, nice boat. And he wanted $500 for it. And it had a big ice chest in it and all that stuff, you know. And so I came home and I walked to the door and I've got this 12-pack hanging over my shoulder, you know. Cool, you know how that is. And I walked up to the door to open the door and she says, where are you going? I said, I'm coming in the house. And she said, not with that beer, you're not. She said, we don't have beer in this house. No alcohol. Well, she had brought her mother. She'd gone and got her mother, and her mother was standing behind her, you know. Well, she knew I wouldn't deck her if her mother was standing there, you know. So, I might not have decked her anyway, I don't know. So I said, okay, that's fine. So I set the beer down. I walked back out to my car, the truck, and I backed out of the driveway. I went back over. I paid that guy $500 for that boat. I put ice in that ice chest. I brought that boat home. I backed it up right beside the house. Now, we lived in a close-knit neighborhood. I mean, I'm telling you, we lived in a cul-de-sac. We had people right beside us. We had people right across the street from us. So I backed this boat up in the driveway right beside the carport, and I iced down all that beer. So I'd come home in the evening, and she'd say, kids have been bathed, food's in the oven, I'm going to meeting. Say, have a nice meeting. I'd go out there and sit in that boat. I'd sit there and drink. My neighbors would come out. I'd wave at them, you know. I don't know what they thought. I really don't know what they thought. They must have thought I was crazy. Anyway, we rocked on like that. And I came home one day and she says, she's on the phone. And she didn't say anything to me as I walked in. And so I opened the refrigerator, and of course, I wasn't in there with soft drinks. And I'm starting to walk out of the room, and I hear her say, well, I love you too, darling, and I'll see you tonight. I said, oh, ho, ho, ho. I got her, buddy. I got her. She done gone and got involved with somebody. Yes, sir, I'm going to get the house, the car, the kids, the whole nine yards. So in a little while, she says to me, they got a meeting over at Clarkson tonight, and it's a speaker meeting. Would you like to go? I would love to go. I would love to go. And I thought, boy, I'm gonna know who this guy is once I get there. I'd pick him out just like that. So we walked over. We walked into the house there, little house at Clarkson, and just as we got inside the door, this girl named Barbara A. jumps up and runs over there and hugs her and says, I love you, sweetie. And I thought, my gosh, I got more problems than I thought I had. What has this woman done? Then I got to looking around and everybody's hugging and carrying on, and I thought, gee whiz. So I sat down there and she says, it's a speaker meeting. I said, oh, you know what a speaker meeting was? So I'm sitting there and there's a guy talking. His name is Gordon Carrington. And this guy has the most horrendous story you've ever heard in your life. But every time he'd mention something that happened to him, he'd mention how he felt. And they started doing that to me, Bo, putting them claws in me. You know, I got restless. I didn't want to sit there. You know, I wouldn't sit still. And he was talking about how he felt. And I thought, doggone. You guys felt like that. I felt like that too, you know. The guilt that I had in my life was overwhelming. Absolutely overwhelming. And remember, we can't tell anybody. Can't tell anybody. Anyway, I was sitting there that night, and this man was sitting there, and his wife was there, and she said, honey, why don't you come to Al-Anon? She said, it's mostly women. I thought, wonderful. Wonderful. She said, we meet over at the Rock of Ages Lutheran Church on Memorial Drive on Monday night. I said, well, I'll try to come. So I went over there and I walked in this Al-Anon meeting. There's all these women. She was right, there's nothing but women in there. I walked in there and I sat down and I meet this woman. In fact, she lives over on St. Simon's right now. And she was a black belt Al-Anon. She says, I want you to meet my husband. And so she introduced me to her husband, a guy named Hal. I went to one or two meetings and I said, people are crazy, you know. And so I left and I didn't come back. Okay, it had been almost 9 months since Carol had gone into AA. And my life was just totally a disaster. If I could draw you a picture of what alcohol had looked like in my house, it would have been Mama and Daddy at 3 o'clock in the morning, both of them drunk, beating the hell out of each other, throwing beer on each other, and three small children trying to pull them apart. Not pretty. Not pretty. I'm not proud of that at all. I'm ashamed of that. But that's what happened. That's absolutely what happened. I want to tell you about my last drunk. We went out to Carol's mother's one time. She lived out in Lawrenceville, about 20 miles from us. And we were taking the kids. And on the way out there, I'm driving. And she says, don't forget, when we come back, we got to stop and get this milk. And I said, okay, when we come by Kroger's, remind me and I'll get it. And she said, okay. So we go out to her mother's and her and her mother go shopping. And her stepfather and I sit down. We're going to watch a ball game and drink some beer. Well, I remember drinking the third beer. And that's the last thing I remember. I woke up the next morning in my bed. And I didn't know how I got there. And I got up and I washed my face and I started getting dressed. And she says, where are you going? I said, I'm going to get some milk. She said, we don't need any milk. I said, what do you mean we don't need any milk? She said, we don't need any milk. So okay, so I walked into the kitchen, I opened the refrigerator, and there's a gallon of milk. Oh, how the hell did that milk get in there? So I walked out there and looked at my car. You know how we do. We walk around our car, look, see, make sure there's no dents in there, because I didn't remember coming home. So I went to work and tried to work, and I couldn't work. And I came home, and I thought, well, I'll cut the grass. So I got out there on the lawnmower and started cutting the grass. I had a riding lawnmower, and I'm riding around in the backyard there, and I'm not paying attention where I'm going. I'm mowing the same place over and over and over, and I'm crying like a baby. I could not stop crying. I stopped. I got off it. I thought, what is the matter with me? I'm coming to pieces. Get a hold of yourself. But I could not stop crying. I hadn't cried for 16 years. I had not cried for 16 years. And now I couldn't stop. I went in the house and I told her, I said, I got to take a shower. So I went and took a shower and I came out and she says, what are you doing? I said, I'm going down on Memorial Drive. Talk to somebody. And she says, it's the milk, isn't it? I said, yeah, it's the milk. I don't remember getting the milk. And she said, well, you drove all of us home and you got out and went in and got that milk. And I said, I don't remember it. So I went down on Memorial Drive and I walked into that meeting and I walked up to this same guy that I had met from his wife. And he was a big tall man, wore glasses and had a deep voice. And I didn't know it at the time, but he was a Rhodes Scholar. He was a member of Mensa. He was a genius. This guy was fantastic as far as working with newcomers. I walked up to him and I said, Hal, do you remember me? And he said, yeah. I said, how do you know you're an alcoholic? And I started crying. He put his arm around me and he says, Jim, I can't tell you you're an alcoholic, but I can tell you that I'm an alcoholic. He said, sit down here. And he started telling me about Hal. And that's the first time that I had gone to anybody and they had said, you got to do this, you got to quit this, you got to do this, you got to do this. Hal didn't tell me that. Hal didn't tell me I had to do anything. He just started telling me about Hal. And I got very uncomfortable. So he said, won't you stay for the meeting? I said, no, I'm fine. I think I've got a hold of myself now. I think I'm going to be all right. And so I left and I went home. And I didn't go to the watering hole and drink. I just went home. And the next morning I went into the office and I picked up the phone and I called him because he had given me his phone number. And I said, Hal, would you meet me somewhere tonight and talk to me some more? I said, I'm coming to pieces. And he said, meet me at Clarkston at 7 o'clock. They got a meeting at 8. I said, okay. So I met Hal, and he talked to me for an hour, and then we went into the meeting. And I'm going to tell you how sick I was. We're sitting in the back of the room, and he says, when they start offering the chips now, you need one. I said, okay. So we're sitting there, and the same girl that was hugging Carol is giving out the chips. It's Barbara A. And she says, is there anybody here tonight that would like to pick up a white chip? And Hal nudges me and says, that one's got your name on it. I jumped up and ran up there, and before I could get there, she handed it to this girl. And I'm trying to take it away from her. And the girl said, hey, we got a whole bunch of them. I thought that thing had my name on it, and they were waiting on me. That's how bad off I was. Anyway, Hal became my first sponsor. And Hal told me something that first night that I'll always remember. He said, if you are alcoholic, you don't have but three choices, Jim. You can come go with us, and you can get sober, or you can die in a mental institution, or you'll die as a result of your own hand. That's the only three choices you've got. And he told it to me, so I believed it. He became my first sponsor. I spent more time with him the first year in Alcoholics Anonymous than I did with my family. But that's how bad off I was. I spent every Saturday morning with him. You know, I worked the 12 steps completely from 1 to 12. I shared my inventory with him. I went all the way through the steps with him. He was wonderful, wonderful. So much wisdom this man has. You know, at 4 years, he went back out and drank. And he got up one morning and got his wife off to work, and he went out and sat in the backyard and put a pistol in his mouth and blew his brains out. Now, did he not prove to me what he said was true, that I don't have but three choices? I love that guy. I loved him. I immediately went back and got me another sponsor. I picked his sponsor, a guy named Jim Lowry. He's dead now. He became my sponsor. He had been sponsoring me for years. Anyway, I asked him, I said, will you be my sponsor? He said, I've been sponsoring you for years. And he was the best thing that ever happened to me. He died about 3 years ago. And I miss him every day. He was the same way. He had so much wisdom. I came in, I started working the steps, and things didn't seem to get better. The relationship was still bad. I don't know how many nights Carol and I would spend at Gay and Al's house, this couple that was her sponsor, and he was an Al-Anon bull. And we would get up, go over to their house at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, and she'd say, come on over, we'll put the coffee on. And we kept those poor people up, and they would sit and share with us. Jim and Helen Lowry, his wife was black belt Al-Anon, and we would go over to their house in the middle of the night and try to talk to them about this relationship. And Jim said to me, how many people do you know that drank together for 16 years and tried to kill each other and then came in the program and got sober and are still married? And I said, I don't know. He said, I know one, Bill Rupa. That's it. He's the only man I know. And you need to go talk to him. And I went and talked to Bill Rupa, and Bill said, oh my gosh, you have got some work to do. And he was absolutely right. I was sitting in a meeting. I had 7 years sobriety. I was sitting in a meeting in Lilburn, and a guy comes over and grabs me and yanks me out of the meeting. That's what sponsors used to do. Yanked me out of the meeting, said, come outside. Looked me right in the face and said, let me tell you something. He said, we don't care whether you get married, or, stay married, or whether you get divorced. We're tired of hearing about it. Now, you either do one or the other, and we could care less what you do. Craziest thing I ever saw. But my sponsor was the same way. He yanked me out of a meeting one night and told me, he said, if you don't get rid of this resentment that you've got with this guy, you're going to get drunk. And he turned around and walked off and got in his car and went home. Well, I showed him. I followed him home. But I got sober, and we saved our marriage around two tables. One of them at Alan Gay's house, and the other one at Jim Lowry and Helen's house, sitting around those kitchen tables talking about how to rebuild a relationship. It's hard. The best advice Jim Lowry ever gave me was, if it happened over 2 weeks ago, you don't talk about it. Because we were the world's worst about it. Oh, yeah? Well, back in 67, you said, we were the world's worst. Oh, that's right. That was over 2 weeks ago. We can't talk about that. He told me to go to marriage counseling one time, and he said, you and Carol need to go to marriage counseling. He said, go home and ask her to go to marriage counseling. I went home and asked her, and she said, I'm not going. I said, you got to go. Jim said, go to marriage counseling. She said, I'm not going. I picked up the phone, called Jim, said, Jim, she said she wasn't going to go. He said, ask her again. I said, I just asked her. He said, ask her again. So I asked her again. She said, she ain't going. I called him back. I said, she still says she ain't going. He said, ask her again. I said, Jim, you're not getting this. I told you she will not go. So I called Jim Lowry back and I said, she will not go to marriage counseling. He said, fine, you go by yourself. He said, here's a man's name. Call him tomorrow and make an appointment. I made an appointment with a Baptist minister to go talk to him. He was also a therapist. I got there and he says, you here for marriage counseling? I said, yes, sir. He said, where's your wife? I said, she won't come. He said, well, what am I supposed to do? I said, I don't know. Jim Lowry sent me here. My sponsors for you. They do and say some of the craziest things, don't they? I called my sponsor one night and I said, one morning and I said, hey, I said, I don't think I'm going to the meeting tonight. He said, well, that's okay. Pick me up at 7 o'clock. I said, wait a minute, you don't understand. I said, I don't think I'm going. He said, don't you understand? We don't care what you think. I mean, they were tough. They were tough. But God love them. They saved my life. I'll tell you, they saved my life. I have two sponsors today. One of them, I just got a new sponsor and because Jim Lowry died, and I got a new sponsor, Bill F., up in Lilburn. And he and I have been friends since I got sober. But now he's my sponsor. I've always had two sponsors. I think you need them. And I got 27 years sobriety, and I still need sponsors. And I talk to them daily, because my thinking's still not good, I did that four-step inventory, and when I got through with it, Hal said, is it complete? And is it honest? And I said, yeah, it is. And he says, is there anything you left out? And I said, no, I don't think so. He said, how about 1965? I had not written a word about 1965, about Vietnam. And I didn't know how I was going to write that. And I was going to a meeting with a guy at Biscayne that night, and I told him I was having a hard time writing about that. And when I came home, he pulled in my driveway and he shut the key off. And he had been a C-141 pilot in Vietnam. And he said, well, let's talk about it. And I sat down in that car and I told him everything that was going on with me. And he said, now go in there and write it. And I went in there and write it. I wrote it, you know, and was able to share that inventory. And I shared that inventory twice. I shared it with my sponsor, and then I shared it with a monk down at the monastery in Conyers. When I got through, that monk walked over there and hugged me and said, thank you so much for sharing your life with me. He said, whether you believe it or not, it was a beautiful life. It's been a beautiful life. And I'm thinking, my gosh, I didn't think it was beautiful, but, you know. But it wasn't all bad. There was a lot of good in there, you know. I found out I wasn't a totally bad person. And I found out that I did not know what happened to those two guys that I left. They may have dropped dead the minute we, you know, got out of the pattern. I don't know. I really don't know. And I'm not to blame for that. Everything that happens in God's green earth is not my fault. I found that out in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's been a lot of things happen. I worked for that airline until 1994. And I was trying to make up my mind whether to leave or whether to stay. And I couldn't make up my mind. And I called my sponsor, who happened to be in New Jersey at that time, and I said, Jim, I'm just having a terrible time with this decision about, you know, this early retirement they've offered me, and what do I do with it? And he said, well, what are you trying to do? I said, well, I'm trying to figure out what God's will is for me. He said, where are you at? And I said, I'm in the office. He said, close the door, and I'll tell you something's going to revolutionize your life. So I closed the door and went back to the phone, and he said, God really doesn't give a damn whether you quit your job or whether you stay there. I thought, well, how insensitive of you to say that? And how insensitive of God? He said, you're at a turning point in your life, and you're going to go to the right or you're going to go to the left. And whichever way you go, God's going with you. Bam, the light came on. The light came on. I walked down the hall, signed the papers. I left that job. 2 months later, I went to work for the Federal Aviation Administration, had the best job I'd ever had in my life. I was flying again, giving check rides to pilots, doing exactly what I wanted to do, and I did that for 12 gorgeous years. You know, so career-wise, I did okay. I did okay for a guy that was a basket case. You know, 2 years ago, I made a decision to retire and help my brothers take care of my dad, who was 94 at the time, and spend time with him. My dad was mentally was very sharp, and I'd go over and spend nights with him, and I'd share with him, and I'd talk to him, and he'd tell me things about the family and about Atlanta, and he was a wealth of information, and we spent so much quality time together. I lost him in May, and but I wouldn't take anything for that time that I've spent. My youngest daughter, who, like I told you, my first daughter, oldest daughter, is still in Al-Anon and has been. The middle daughter, I don't know what's the matter with her. She doesn't need anything. She has three children, and she functions fine, and she just does everything just the way it's supposed to be done. I don't know. I don't understand that. My youngest daughter is picked up a white chip when she was 18 years old. And but didn't stay sober. Picked up a white chip when she was 25, didn't stay sober. 3 years ago, she picked up a white chip, and she's still sober today, you know. The oldest daughter probably saw the worst part of the alcoholism in our house. But it is a family disease. It affects every member of the family. Absolutely. Carol has 9 more months than me. She loves me to say that. She said, I'll never catch her. And I hope and pray to God I never do. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I worry sometimes about people in Alcoholics Anonymous, are they getting everything? I want to tell you a little story. There was a guy that lived in South Georgia, and his parents were sharecroppers. And they, the boy just worked from sunup to sundown and went to school, and that's all he ever did. He never had any pleasure in life. And when he turned 16, the circus came to McRae. And his parents said, he's 16, he needs to go to the circus. And so they scraped around there and they got 50 cents up. And they gave it to him and they told him, son, if you can walk into town, you can go to the circus. And so the boy walked into town. And when he got there on the main street, he saw this band coming. And he saw these elephants and these tigers and all of these things from the circus. And he was just elated. He had never seen anything like it in his life. You know, people on trapezes and juggling and everything else. And the kid stood there and stood there and stood there. And when the clowns came, which was the end of the parade, the clowns came. And the one clown walked by him and he tipped his hat. And the boy put 50 cents in the clown's hat and turned around and went home and told his parents how wonderful the circus was. You see, he didn't see the circus. He saw the parade. That's what worries me about Alcoholics Anonymous and some people in it. Are they getting everything that's possible to give here? Have they seen the circus or have they just seen the parade? There is so much here to get. If you work these steps and apply these principles to your life and do these inventories and share that, there's so much happiness to be had. I want it all. I'll be honest with you. I want it all. I want the circus. You know? I've lost a lot of good friends in Alcoholics Anonymous who died sober. I've lost some people that went back out and drank. I lost Hal, you know, and I've lost a lot of other ones that that said, maybe I really don't need y'all. You know, maybe I can do this on my own. And they've gone back out, and then the first thing you know, you get a phone call, and it's time to go to a funeral, you know. I certainly do appreciate your attention tonight, and I hope maybe you've got something out of this. I certainly did. The most important thing that I can say tonight, as far as I'm concerned, is that my name's Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I just want to thank you for being here, and I want to thank you, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the God of my understanding for giving me back my life. Thank you.